Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, I speak to Berkeley author Bonnie Tsui, whose new book, Why We Swim, takes a deep dive into the pleasures, science, and history of swimming, an activity many of us are missing during this pandemic. Later, we'll hear from Bay Area jazz and blues vocalist Kim Nally on her latest album, Lullabies for My Daughters. But first, this week, six Bay Area counties confirmed that the shelter-in-place order would be extended until the end of May. And nationally, almost 60,000 people have died from COVID-19. That is more than died in the two decades of the Vietnam War. To talk more about the latest developments in the COVID-19 crisis, from shelter in place to testing, for hopes for a vaccine by fall and promising results for a treatment available now, I'm glad to welcome back to our program Aaron Alde, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Peter, we can't hear you there. So while Peter's getting his audio working, I'll go ahead and start with you, yes. Aaron. So much of the Bay Area shelter-in-place mandate, as I just mentioned, was extended to the end of May. Marin and Sonoma counties announced that they are relaxing some of their restrictions. Can you explain how these differences have come about, and how is the Bay Area considering its moves county by county versus in a block moving forward?
So right from the start, six counties in the Bay Area, six of the nine counties gathered together and decided to operate kind of as one region, issuing a single sort of shelter in place order with some very small differences from county to county. But for the most part, the exact same thing, same timeline. The three other counties, Sonoma County has largely followed along with the other six. Napa County has also largely followed along, been a little bit looser. And then Solano County has been a little bit more rogue and done its own thing. But all that aside, I mean, the truth is that all nine counties in the Bay Area are kind of on the same page. Solano County recently extended its shelter in place until mid-May. It may end up extending a little bit from there. They may just decide to open up. I think one thing that we need to keep in mind with these orders is, nobody, in the Bay Area is talking about, a wide grand reopening anytime soon. So it's all just kind of, by measures. So it's just going to be, it's almost, just word choice at this point. We're loosening things, allowing some more outdoor activities, giving people a few more kind of freedoms to go outside and maybe interact. But, there's nowhere in the Bay Area where anybody's saying we're ready to go back to work. We're ready to go back to school. We're ready to go back to, regular social interactions. That's not really happening anywhere anytime soon.
So tell us a little bit more about what activities have been loosened, restrictions have been loosened that were announced today.
Right. So I believe that this starts on Monday, by the way, for the most part, for these six Bay Area counties. And it's largely just more outdoor activities. So, for recreational purposes, it's, golf courses, anything that's, parks and skate parks, things like that, anything that's outside where people aren't going to be using shared equipment and they're not going to be, interacting physically. So, you still can't go to basketball courts. You still can't, they're not going to open up playgrounds where there's shared equipment that kids would be crawling all over. In addition to these outdoor activities, they're allowing some outdoor businesses to reopen. So they're going to be allowing construction to resume. They'll be making sure that people are safe about it so that they're keeping their distance, but you will be allowed to start up construction projects again. Things like real estate is going to be opening up. You can still do real estate, you can do real estate interactions, but you can't have like open houses in the same way. Nurseries, plant nurseries will be opening, car washes, things that are like outside are just deemed safer. And again, as long as people continue to maintain those, 6 feet apart social distancing practices.
And does law enforcement have enough person power to be able to monitor people as they venture forth?
Well, what we've been hearing is that this will be similar to what, we've seen in our previous kind of iterations of shelter in place, which is a lot of this is sort of up to people behaving themselves. If we start to see, you know, evidence that there's problems, that people are abusing this, then we may lose some of these privileges. They may, you know, they may decide, you know, people can't go to golf courses anymore if everybody's, you know, meeting up and, you know, sharing equipment and hiring caddies and doing things they're not supposed to do. But if it's, you know, smaller things, I think, you know, we've seen certainly in some places already that there have been citations that have been issued. So like down in Santa Cruz, I think that when they reopened their beaches about a week or two ago, you know, the beaches got to be really crowded. And so law enforcement came down and told people to break it up and threatened to issue citations. So certainly that's something that happens. And I think that's the kind of thing that with all of this, they're just going to be keeping a close eye on it. And if, again, people aren't behaving themselves, then they may, you know, lock things down again, or hopefully, you know, they can just do it like on an individual basis and issue citations. But I don't think at this point that they're worried too much about having the staff to stay on top of these things. I think they're kind of counting on people, you know, the thing with social media is if people are misbehaving, we're going to see evidence of that all over the place.
Right. And Peter, the other big news of the last 24 hours or so are on the medical front is a promising study of the antiretroviral drug that can be available now for treatment. And then also some positive reports out of Germany that a vaccine that is being co-developed with Pfizer might be ready for the fall. What's your take on those two developments?
First of all, Pache, how's the volume now? Can you hear me?
Great.
Oh, awesome. So let's talk first about remdesivir. It's kind of been an ID infectious disease folks kind of dream, not regularly we think about, but because if you guys remember, we've been talking about antiparasitics, gout medicines, rheumatoid arthritis medicines, malaria drugs, and disinfectant. And compared to those things, I'm really excited about an antiviral drug for virus. How about that? So I think given the results today, which I think people were surprised by, it was really spurred on by the knowledge that The Lancet was going to publish the Chinese data and their RCT, which didn't look that great. And I think we're not really comparable to the Chinese experience per se. The other RCTs were global in scope, and there are a lot of potential co-interventions in the Chinese data. But I think that spurred on Gilead to do two press releases, and in a surprise move, the NIH to do a press release of their own, showing that there was actually promise in the antiviral drug, given the US and other global data, to balance out the Chinese data that was being published in The Lancet.
So how soon will remdesivir be used?
So I think right now, the way I think about it, it's still a silver medalist in my medals. I think once the randomized controlled trial gets peer-reviewed and published, I think we'd have more confidence that this is actually a real effect. Right now, the next phase of the NIH study is going to be looking at remdesivir with an anti-inflammatory drug. So like HIV, we think there'll be multiple hits that we'd need, not just one agent. And I think that will be the next phase. And then given these results, we'll know and understand how to best incorporate all these medicines together.
Okay, so let's move then to the Pfizer vaccine that's being co-developed with a German biotech company. Tell us more about that one.
Yeah, so I think the Pfizer German collaboration is one of several promising vaccine developments. And I think the global comment about that is that it's happening a little bit faster than people thought, given, you know, our hopes dashed with HIV vaccine development over and over again. We feel hopeful and then it's kind of dashed. It's very different from HIV. First of all, it's a simpler kind of virus. It's one type mainly. It hasn't really mutated much. It's very different from influenza, where it changes year to year based on the H and N proteins. So I think personally, it may be a little bit easier for people to figure out what antigen will really make the body angry and stimulate them given with an adjuvant. So the German group and Pfizer is one. The Oxford group has been really promising. There's been a group in India. A lot of people, I think, have been front runners and much faster than we think. I think the next phase will be really telling, which is, again, you know, as you know, it has to go through all these phases before it gets used widely. And but I'm hopeful. Again, we think of the vaccine as being really the next step before we can return to the life we aspire to.
And so is fall considered too aspirational at this point?
I think so, actually. I mean, because we've been talking about 12 to 18 months in the original timeline, I think fall is a bit too much. I'm happy that we may be able to get to, you know, early phase studies, but not necessarily to that large scale vaccine intervention yet. But I'm crossing my fingers.
So Aaron Alday, this brings us back to the question of testing and how testing may get us out of some of this shelter in place. Your paper published today that LA County is offering tests to any residents the city of LA is offering tests to any residents with or without symptoms. How did LA manage to do that? And could you imagine the Bay Area following suit?
I think that the Bay Area, well, to be honest, I don't know at this point enough details about it to know why LA was able to manage that and why we haven't been able to in the Bay Area. I think, you know, this whole situation has been really chaotic and, you know, it's varied a lot city to city, county to county. Even here in the Bay Area, it's varied a lot from county to county as far as just who has the testing, you know, resources to test enough people, however you qualify enough. You know, I do think increasingly I'm hearing from the counties here that we don't need to be at a place where we're testing every single person who wants to get a test. I think that that's, you know, a nice idea, but the thinking is that we don't necessarily need to be at that level quite to be able to reopen, you know, to have it be, you know, every single person who wants to get tested for whatever reason is able to get tested. I get the impression that that's not what they're looking at as sort of their endpoint, their goal point for reopening. What they do want is for everybody who's symptomatic, for sure, to be able to be tested. That is definitely a goal that is kind of across the board. And then to be able to test, you know, people who are asymptomatic, who don't have any symptoms, if they are in jobs that are either, you know, high risk for the individual or that puts them at risk of infecting others who may be vulnerable. So people who work in nursing homes would be an obvious target for that, since we have several cases of, you know, staff at nursing homes who did not have any symptoms but who were infected, then going on to infect residents. So you would want to be able to test those people and to be able to test them pretty frequently, to be honest, before we felt safer, you know, reopening. So that's kind of the, you know, what the word that I'm hearing from folks in the Bay Area. So this kind of idea of testing everybody isn't necessarily out there, at least as far as reopening. I think there still is a lot, you know, I have a lot of questions. There's a lot of answers we're all trying to get as to what that looks like. I think with the orders that came out today, they were talking about needing to reach in Bay Area counties, I want to say it was about 200 tests per 100,000 residents per day needs to be done. And at least, you know, by the numbers that are out there now, we're still pretty far off from that.
So, Peter, I imagine you have an opinion on this issue. What do you think about LA's move? And what do you think about the Bay Area counties who are not striving to match LA in testing everyone, symptomatic or not?
So that's a great question, and I agree completely with Aaron. I think what happened is our thinking has evolved a little bit with, you know, given the relatively low numbers that we're seeing in the Bay Area. I think the focus of public health now is not only testing, which we realized we couldn't really do well, but actually having the workforce to do contact tracing. So I think that's actually the newest initiative by the public health group, because even if you can't do all testing, if you can, like, as Aaron pointed out, kind of lower the bar for who you're going to test and test high-risk individuals who are going to go into high-risk situation. But you have the staff, because remember, public health has been defunded for a very long time. So they had to really train and bolster that workforce to go out and zoom out and, like, test all these people around these index cases and then contain them and keep them away from everyone else. So if you did that over and over again, it becomes quite potent as a strategy.
So you feel confident that not broadening testing to all residents, symptomatic or not, is going to be okay for us?
As long as you have the other bit in place, which is contact tracing. But again, you need to have a barometer of how your community is doing. In San Francisco, they've done really creative things, like in the absence of testing, that is using smart thermometers to figure out what the fever is like in the community, or using citizen science where people from all around the community call in with their symptoms. So you can follow those curves in addition to having some limited testing because we couldn't do everyone. And really developing that workforce, librarians, medical student volunteers, people from the DA office, they've all jumped in to help do the contact tracing and be trained to do so.
And Aaron, there's been lots of talk as part of this contact tracing effort to use our smartphones as a way to help us out in this attempt to decrease the spread of the infection. Have you heard about any plans in the Bay Area? I know there was a lot of flurry about Apple and Google joining forces and collaborating, but there hasn't been a lot of discussion about implementation. What have you heard?
So I'll say, in the people that I've had conversations with this about, and I've actually had quite a few, there's a lot of excitement and enthusiasm for the potential of smartphones. And certainly that kind of, those apps and things were very, very useful and applied a lot in other countries, in South Korea in particular, I believe. But the truth is that, A, we don't really have that technology right now, you know, that we're willing and ready to use in the United States and in the Bay Area. And I don't think anybody wants to wait for that stuff to be ready before we talk about reopening. Whereas contact tracing, I mean, that's old school. We know how to do that. We know how to do that actually really well, as long as we have, you know, the staff, as long as we have enough people to do it. That's something that the United States, it's, you know, as they say, it's their bread and butter in public health. That's just something that they know how to do. They're really good at it. So as long as we have the resources, that should do the trick. The other issue with the smartphone apps is exciting as they are, and there is a lot of potential, you know, it would require in this country buy-in and consent. And so you'd have to have a lot of people, you know, agreeing to frankly be monitored by their smartphones. You know, we're real big on privacy here. And if you don't have enough people buying in and you don't have enough people consenting to have their information used that way, then they kind of really lose their power pretty quickly. So that's something that I think needs to be worked out. Certainly that was an issue with the Google and Apple apps that were talked about, is that they do require buy-in, that they do require an opt-in. And there was some skepticism in the folks I talked to that they would kind of reach that power anytime soon.
So the other part of contact tracing, of course, is that once you identify people who are potentially exposed or who are unable to self-isolate, that you find places for them to isolate and quarantine. And so the city has put funds towards helping to place people who are experiencing homelessness or who can't otherwise shelter in place by putting them up in hotel rooms. And I know that, you know, there was the numbers, 7,000, 8,000 hotel rooms were bandied about, the Board of Supervisors wanting more, and our mayor saying that we could only afford around 7,000. How successful has the city been in getting people into those rooms, not only procuring them, but then actually outfitting them and getting people in them and keeping them there?
So I think that there's a little bit of two different topics here, which is one with the contact tracing and people potentially needing to be put in quarantine. That's kind of a broader group of people that may apply to, you know, that could be not necessarily people who are homeless, but people who live in just crowded situations where they need to be pulled out of like a family with like, you know, multi-generational family, and they may need a place, a safe space to stay for a couple weeks. The housing that they're seeking now, these hotel rooms, is specifically for people who are homeless or people who are in, you know, SROs, people who are in situations where there aren't really any options for them to currently shelter safely. And that's been a challenge, and the city has fallen far short of the 8,000 rooms, which the Board of Supervisors put on San Francisco, on the mayor to come up with. I think they're at what, like a couple thousand as of today or as of earlier this week. So they're really nowhere near that. And I don't think anybody actually expected them to hit 8,000. The hope was that would sort of drive to get, you know, at least move things much faster along. The issue they've run into largely is, you know, I mean, it's obviously expensive, but when you're talking about sheltering people who are homeless, you know, they often have a lot of issues that also need to be addressed. So you need to find out, you know, you need to come up with a way to give them food. You need to come up with a way to keep their rooms safe and clean, to provide them with social services, provide them with healthcare. There's a lot of sort of support that these folks need, that would have to be provided for them in order for them to shelter in these places safely. And we're also talking about them sheltering there for quite some time. So I don't even know that there is sort of a deadline for how long, you know, these folks would need to be staying in these hotel rooms. I would imagine it's until shelter in place is lifted more. So presumably until the end of May, if not beyond that.
Peter, I wanted to go to the ever expanding list of symptoms that are associated with potential coronavirus infection that was published by the CDC quietly last week. And then the growing reports about many other organ systems like kidneys and being affected, strokes and heart attacks, that perhaps wasn't in our sights up front, or at least happening more frequently than we expected. What do you make of this expansion in the symptoms and in the effects of coronavirus? Is this typical of what happens when we're dealing with a new infection, that we're much of the way into it, and then we realize with more experience that there's a lot more there?
So I think you bring up 2 points, Pache. The first is the CDC expansion of symptoms, and I have strong ideas about both of these things. The first issue about expansion of symptoms, I feel like a little bit disappointed, because if I'm somebody in the community reading that, it seems that, you know, I woke up this morning with a sore throat and myalgias. Does that make me think I have COVID-19? Probably if I didn't know much about COVID-19, I'd be worried. Because there's no prioritization of these symptoms. I still think the old-fashioned fever, cough is really ruling, and the smell disturbance. Actually, that's the only new one that I really think is really specific to COVID-19. Actually, one of my colleagues from Emory probably gave me the best rule ever. You wake up in the morning, you feel for a temperature, and you smell your coffee. If you don't have a fever and you can smell your coffee, you're pretty much good to go. I like the idea of the CDC expansion of symptoms. One thing, which is what Erin brought up before, if it means that more people are going to be tested because of these vague symptoms, that's great. But don't make me feel anxious as a community member, because I might have allergies. And if I read the CDC sort of flat line, I can have anything and have COVID, I'd feel a little bit worried. So that's the way I'd put those two things together.
Right, especially if testing is not going to be as readily available once
Correct.
You start adding more and more symptoms. I wanted to end this segment with the two of you on a little bit of a more personal note, because you've been so great of giving of your time and your expertise and your reporting to us over the last few weeks. I just want to hear how it's going for you. The California Department of Public Health published tonight that 5,000 healthcare workers across the state have been infected with the coronavirus. Peter, what's it like for you and your colleagues to continue to do this work?
I know it's, thanks for that great question. I mean, I think it's really tough for us to pause and think about ourselves and our family. I mean, we all have different strategies. I know many of my colleagues, myself, we've actually quarantined ourselves from our families when we're actively seeing COVID patients. So that's one issue. The other issue is the personal aspect of it, not only of taking care of our patients, but of our colleagues, our staff members, our nurses, our faculty members, where the tables are turned and now, you know, we're taking care of our own people as well as patients. So I think that personal aspect was a little bit unanticipated personally. Mm.
And Erin, we talked before we went to air about the fact that you needed a couple of days off from the very voluminous in-depth reporting that you have been doing. And in fact, the Chronicle also put out that people out there are kind of needing a break from all this, and they don't know what sources to trust. How are you as a reporter doing with all this, and how are your colleagues coping?
Right. So it's definitely been challenging. It's been, you know, I keep using the word relentless, just as far as the coverage and staying on top of things. There's just, it's such a dynamic situation. There's so much news going on. It's constantly evaluating what's real, what's not, what's the truth. And that stuff changes all the time. You know, we were talking early on with this, I think with the editor-in-chief, about, this was back like in early March, about fire season and how, you know, as a staff at the newspaper, we're used to covering big breaking news events, things like fires and earthquakes. And, you know, when you have all hands on deck and people are just working, you know, crazy hours for days at a time, even like a week or two at a time. But now we're talking about being in this crisis mode, what feels like crisis mode, for months. And that's just, I think we're all in a place where it's a level of exhaustion that we've kind of never dealt with before. And obviously, you know, we're not on the front lines for the most part. We do have, you know, photographers, we have people that are out there that are really, you know, putting themselves at risk, and they're dealing with some of the kind of frontline issue where they're having to be very careful about, you know, keeping themselves and their loved ones safe. So there certainly is some of that going on. But I think for the rest of us, you know, it's just the usual. I mean, we're all kind of isolated. We're working from home. We're separated when we're used to being in a newsroom together and kind of that level of teamwork and social interaction. So there's that kind of separation, while at the same time, it's, you know, nobody ever disengages. It's just, it feels like a 24-hour thing. So I do think we're all figuring out, and this isn't something that journalists tend to be very good at, but the importance of unplugging. And I think that's something just as a society, we're all kind of learning is so important to do, to just, you know, turn everything off, to disengage as much as you possibly can, and, you know, go for a hike, to go outside, breathe fresh air, you know, do whatever you can to kind of turn it off. I've never personally felt that to be so important. I mean, it's really a requirement, in a way that I hadn't anticipated.
Well, I want to thank both of you then for giving us time after very long days and weeks of doing this important work. So I want to thank again Aaron Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist at UCSF. We'll look forward to talking with you next week. Thanks.
Yeah, again. We can talk about clots for sure.
Okay, excellent.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, Pache.
Thanks, Peter.
Now for something completely different. We turn next to Berkeley author Bonnie Tsui, whose descriptions of the magic of sea dreaming and flow in her new book, Why We Swim, may lure even the most determined landlubbers into the water. Bonnie is also the author of a book, American Chinatown, published in 2009. She seems to be swimming everywhere in the world, but especially here in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I want to welcome Bonnie Tsui to City Visions.
Thanks so much, Joe.
So thanks for being the person who's going to take us out of the COVID cave that we're in right now and bring us out into the water. And I want to remind our listeners that this is a great time for you to join our conversation as well here on City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco. So are you a swimmer? Let us know. We want to hear about what you're missing about being out of the water and how you're compensating, so to speak. Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to cityvisions@kalw.org or find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. So Bonnie, I understand that you're an avid swimmer and this lockdown must be hard on you. How are you coping?
You know, I am, the pools are closed, obviously, for all of us. But I have been, you know, we're lucky enough here in the Bay Area that the coast is still available to us, at least for the time being. And I think we've been pretty responsible in conducting ourselves on the beaches. So they've stayed open. And I know that we've probably seen lots of photos from Southern California over this past weekend when it was pretty hot out, and the crowds approximated that those of Florida during spring break. And, you know, I think that we're just all doing our best here, and we all are climbing up the walls and wanting to be, back to our normal routines. And so I think thus far we've done a good job here in Northern California, kind of being responsible with using the shoreline. And so I don't know, I'm fingers crossed that we can still have open waters available to us. So I haven't been able to get to the pool as everyone hasn't for the most part, unless you're lucky enough to have access to a private pool. But to answer your question, I've been able to get into, into the water every now and again. And so that's kept me sane for sure.
Great. And so when you're not in the water, what is it about swimming that you can bring into your land life or life on land to get you through this?
I think that I have actually been talking about this with a lot of people recently, and a lot of swimmers who have been landlocked, and in a way that's unaccustomed to them, and you can kind of, they keep calling themselves fish out of water, and it's like, it's pretty true. I mean, it's tough for folks who, especially those who for whom water is the escape and the sort of time that they have every day to kind of come back to themselves and to stay healthy. I mean, especially older people for whom the water, it's like maybe it's the morning exercise class, maybe it's the morning swim is the only time they can really feel comfortable and happy in their bodies. And that's a very real thing. And I think to not be able to have that is tough when it is the way that you've been accustomed to coping with the challenges in life. And I feel that in a very real way.
And you talk a lot in your book of how swimming is very personal for you. It's sort of baked into your family of origin story. Tell us about how you got to be a swimmer in the first place.
The origin story, of course, is that my parents met in a swimming pool in Hong Kong, and it all came from there. And we, swam from a young age. Did swim team and became lifeguards, and just had this lifelong relationship that started at Jones Beach in New York and kind of carries over till now. And the sort of sad, realization I made over the course of writing the book was that no one in my family swims anymore except for me. And it was the way we all bonded and spent time together in my early life. And so it was kind of strange to realize, the last time that my father went swimming was when I went to China and visited him and made him get in the ocean or made him get in the water. And, my mom, I don't know, hasn't been in the pool in years. And my brother, again, similar things. Like, I had to be the one to lead him back. And he said, I can still do this. I can still be faster than you. And he claims, but guess what? You need maintenance, my friend.
Well, that surprises me, because you did talk a lot about your healthy competition with your...
Oh, yeah. Yes, absolutely.
This reminds me of how your book begins, which is talking about how humans are not natural swimmers, and yet somehow we are drawn to the water, and we do need to learn how to swim, but somehow it's in there somewhere. Tell us about how you have looked at the relationship between the humankind and water, and especially swimming.
It is really interesting. Humans are, we have a weird relationship with water, because we're unique among terrestrial mammals in that we have to learn how to do it. We don't instinctively know how to swim from birth. And, dogs can do it, cats can do it, mice can do it. You look around, and all of these animals we're so closely related to can, but we cannot, and we have to teach ourselves to do it. Even bats. I mean, bats can swim, we cannot swim. If you look up videos of bat swimming, it's pretty amazing. The sort of higher order primates, we just have to, like chimpanzees and orangutans, they've done some studies on can they swim and can they be taught. And so in a similar way, they can be. And it's interesting, because we are all despite that, we're drawn to the water. We're drawn to the water clearly for survival, but there's also something kind of mystical about it. There's something really mesmerizing about the sight and sound of water. And we know that when the evidence is like, we go walk along the beach, we're drawn to the ocean. We want to build our houses, you know, there, despite sea level rise and erosion and all that. And it's just like, we are drawn to it for something more than, you know, that we need it to drink and we need it to, as, you know, biological beings to survive. And it's, you know, it does something to our brains. It is something that is beneficial and healthy for our brains as well as our bodies.
So yes, you talk about how our relationship with water is about survival. It's about, you know, competition, whether it be sportsman like competition or battle and war, as we'll talk about in a moment from an example from Japan that you talk a lot about. You've also mentioned a lot about how it builds community for you and that being in the pool or being with around other swimmers. And then this concept of flow, mm-hmm. that almost like a kind of a meditative mind body meld, so to speak, with the water, or I should say mind body water trilogy there. How did you see this? Did you have this idea as you were writing the book that's what you were going to set out to talk about, those five or so aspects, well-being being another one of them? Or how did you kind of come across this way of conceptualizing our
right
our
the structure of the book was it was a tough one to figure out, and I spent quite a few years just sort of like collecting stories and kind of back going away and trying to see how the sort of logical way that it would fit together in a narrative form, you know, because it's swimming is obviously such a big topic, and I wanted to have something for people to hold on to when they read the book. And it became clear to me over time and after talking to some pretty smart writing and editor friends of mine that to have a question, to pose a question from the get-go, to call it something as simple as why we swim, so that people who saw the book would know that immediately what the book is about. And then everything kind of fell into place. All of the things, all the research that I'd sort of done, the stories I collected fell into these five categories of, you know, survival, of course. Like, first and foremost, we have to survive the water in order to be able to talk about swimming being anything else. And then, you know, after that, it just sort of was with well-being and health, right? So that was another aspect of swimming that was clear to me. And then community, of course, with teams and sort of like the tribe of swimmers that you have when you come together and you have this shared love of something. And competition, of course, is the sublimation of survival, you know, our survival instincts into something that is a little like lower stakes, but that fight or flight, it can be harnessed into this. It's like any sport. It's like the thrill of racing and competition is so much of those instincts that we had into this sort of like safe frame, right, of that and experiencing that. And then flow was something that to me was so important to land on, because it is what I thought was a really useful antidote to modern life, you know, this immersion, this escape from connectivity, this way to find quiet and time with yourself, and in a world where it is not easy to escape from everyone else. It's not easy to escape from the constant rings and pings of other people. And, you know, current situation notwithstanding, it is hard to disconnect, I mean, from technology, and being in the water is one of those ways that you can do that.
I was really interested to hear about the personalities or the temperaments, so to speak, of different types of strokes, breaststroke versus butterfly, mm-hmm. versus backstroke. Can you tell us a little bit more about this conceptualization that you have of the personalities of the different types of strokes?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think everyone has this, or all swimmers who have competed on some level, like they ascribe certain personality traits through the different strokes. And I think that the one that I will speak the most about, and because I can identify with, is breaststroke. And breaststroke is the slow stroke. Breaststroke is the stroke that is like not as fun, it's boring. It's the one that you rely on if you're trying to rest. And but I feel like there's something hidden in there. And I write about that in the book. It's like, you know, there's like a hidden speed in the rhythm. Like it's camouflage, but you can, when you kind of slow down instead of, and cut out like a hurried bobbing, like you have, there's a hidden strength, the kick and the pull and the rhythm. And once you get that right, you're just like flying. And it's not an easy stroke to master, but it's one that I loved as a kid and was the stroke that was my stroke when I competed as a club swimmer when I was a kid. And I still feel like it's something that teaches you patience, because you have to wait. You have to wait to glide and you have to wait to pull. And there's something, you know, like a life lesson to be learned from that. And that's the one I always kind of go back to that.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and you can join our conversation with Bonnie Tsui, author of Why We Swim, by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@KALW.org. Or find us on Twitter. We're at City Visions KALW. So let's talk about the time you spent studying the history of swimming in Japan that goes back centuries and has a very clear connection to samurai warriors. You call it, there's a so-called swimming martial art. Tell us about your discovery there and how you connect this back to some of the things you've been talking about with me tonight.
In Japan, it's called Nihon Eho. And that's the sort of modern day way of describing Japanese classical swimming. And what that really is, like you said, it's the Japanese swimming martial art, like judo or kendo. And it's one of the skills that were so prized by samurai back in the feudal period in Japan. And so if you think about all of the samurai clans protecting different parcels of land back in that time, that you would have some parcels of land that were on the coast, and so were on the ocean, or some that were on rivers, or some that were on lakes. And so each of the clans, each of the samurai clans had their own schools of swimming that prized certain techniques for how to defend against enemies coming from the ocean or the lakes or the stream. And so they, you know, I wish I could visually show you how to do this, but we'll have to look it up, or you have to read the book, where you've got strokes that cut through waves. If you're kind of going out to sea and your head is up to sight an enemy or see where you're going, or when you're crossing a very calm body of water, a moat, or, you know, you're crossing a lake where you're trying to be very quiet. And so you have to be very silent and also not create a lot of ripples. So you have these techniques to tread water, keep your head really low, be very quiet in your body, and just work with the water. The whole thing about samurai swimming, even today, is that you work with the water. You don't fight it. And so you learn to conduct your body in a way that is one with the water. And so I think this is sort of like, you know, what we were talking about a little bit just before about breaststroke, where you have to be in control of, it's not just about speed. It's about you being part of the water and doing something more beautiful because you understand how the water works and how your body works in the water. And, with like the swimming martial art, as with many martial arts, that there's a mind body component. There's an element of thinking about skill and moving up and studying under a master and mastering certain things that allow you to advance to a greater understanding of what it is to be in the world. And so I think there's something really beautiful about that lesson, especially when it comes to swimming. And it's not really what we normally think about in the West about swimming and about what is achievement in swimming. What is it about mastering how to conduct yourself in the water. And so I found that really fascinating.
Right. So which when you're saying that, I imagine you mean Western swimming is about speed and strength. Mm-hmm. And this is about stealth and poise.
Right. And efficiency and patience and all of these virtues that you actually, you know, a lot of these skills were associated with patience, with, endurance and with benevolence, you know, like learning how to resuscitate someone was associated, was an act of benevolence, right? And it still is. And it was to kind of read about it and learn about it in this codified way was really eye-opening.
Great. We have a caller. We have Dave in San Francisco. Welcome, Dave, to the program.
Yeah. How are you doing this evening?
Pretty good. Hey.
Well, I just wanted to, I have a tiny bit of Japanese. I'm mostly Northern European, by the way. So I know some of this culture. But San Francisco, back home, had a rich history of pools. You had Fleischhacker Pool, I think it was a 300-meter pool, with natural seawater from the ocean. And I think it was sometime during the 70s, from what I know by my history, they sort of closed it. And then way before that, you know, decades ago, you had the Sutro Baths, you know, where the cliff house is now. And
yes,
it burned down and stuff. But, you know, that was a great place in the pictures I've seen so far as bathing. But I'm not very happy today with the pools in the city. Except for one, they're all indoor, that heavy stench of chlorine. The only outdoor pool is one tiny little thing I call a waiting pool out in the Mission District. It's the only outdoor pool in, public-wise in San Francisco. But down the peninsula in San Mateo and also in Concord, they have a regular 50-meter, Olympic-sized pools with diving and all that. It seems to be quite fun. I wanted to find out if you kind of know of any other possible good pools in the Bay Area.
Well, I wanted to first acknowledge your note about Fleischhacker Pool, which is it's in the book, and it was an incredible feat of architecture. They had lifeguards in rowboats because the pool was so big. It was like 1,000 feet long.
Rowboats?
Oh, my God. And it had, you know, millions of gallons of seawater in it, as you mentioned. And it was, imagine that. Like, that would be incredible to have today. I am with you in terms of, I wish that there were more pools that were of the open air variety. I live in Berkeley now, and so there are many outdoor pools within like a 2-mile radius of where I live. When I lived in San Francisco, I often swam on the rooftop pool in Mission Bay, and that was my sort of oasis. But I feel that to your point about pools just being more accessible to more people. Like I personally think that in the States it would be wonderful to have universal, swimming education in public schools the way they have in many other countries, in Japan.
Yeah, there was an article in the Chronicle a number of years ago about the pools here. They had too much time for lap swimmers and not enough time for children and recreational swimming. And the pool by me, the Rossi pool, is all torn up. They're in the process of remodeling it. But they've got to work on the schedule here to make it more accessible, for recreational use, not just the lap swimmers.
Thanks so much for your call, Dave.
Okay.
We also have a couple of emails, one from Catherine. Catherine states, I'm a swimmer on my high school team and I swim the 500-meter event. I'd love the idea of flow that Bonnie talks about. And I also noticed that if you let your mind wander too much, you might drown.
So. It's true. I mean, the line between survival and, not survival and swimming and drowning and life and death is very, it's a thin line.
That's in general our relationship with water, right? Is that it's
yes.
That fine line.
It is. And I think that that's part of the thrill. It's part of what is so magical and powerful about being in the water is that we are not at home in it. We have to learn to conduct ourselves in it safely in a way so that we can appreciate it for something more than just like being able to not die in it. And so there is something really intense and really, I think that it can bring so much more vividness to, to an experience, to be in the water, to be especially in open water where that danger is ever more present and ever more acute than in a pool. And I think that's why part of why what draws open water swimmers to oceans and lakes and rivers and streams is just like there's something a little bit, there's an added element to it.
We have another email from Mary in San Francisco. She says, so nice to talk about swimming. I'm an avid swimmer. And one of the tough things to think about with this shelter in place is that the city might not open the public pools again. Does the author think swimming is safe? And I guess she means within the context of coronavirus.
Right, of course. Before all the pools closed, across the country, the CDC actually said, made some statements about pool water being actually pretty safe because it's treated obviously with chlorine and is treated in a way to kill viruses and to kill bacteria and to, for all intents and purposes, the water itself is quite safe. And it was really the environment around the pool. So environment around the water, rather, like on the pool deck and the locker rooms, that was hazardous. And of course, now we know that it is the congregating around the pool that is something that was not safe and isn't going to be safe until, something changes. And so that is, I think that that's kind of sad and that's ironic because the water itself is not the thing that's going to kill us. It's being around the water, all of us around it. And so it's sad because, like I said before, so many people depended upon the water in pools, warm water, indoor pools, outdoor pools to be healthy, to exercise and to get the activity that they need to stay healthy. And so I feel, that I think that that is a real, it's like so many things in this pandemic period, that is like, it's one of those things that's a real loss.
Well, I can't leave you without talking about your 2019 New York Times opinion piece entitled, "You Are Doing Something When You Aren't Doing Anything," which is one of the most shared stories when it was published last summer. And that you, in there, you argue that fallow time, which is an agricultural term, but also can mean idling or resting or being quiescent, was critical to be able to be productive or doing good in other parts of your life. How can you tie that into our current state of sheltering in place?
I'm so glad you asked that. I have been thinking about that intensely in recent weeks because I am, that piece has now led to a book that I am writing on fallow time. And as my husband says, this is the greatest experiment in fallow time in human history. That is like an enforced condition. And so to listen to people and to ask them about, how this is altering their perception, the perceptions of themselves, the perceptions of what it means to be a productive human in society, how they, the various standards they have held themselves to. I mean, it is like all of these things are changing, and I don't have answers for you, concrete answers for you yet, but I am working on it. And it is really interesting because like before the coronavirus, it was, everything is like pedal to the metal. We're all moving along as we have been accustomed to. And so this interruption, swimming was a way to escape from that, right? So we've talked about that, and it was like a refuge and a sort of escape and solace from that pace of things. Mm. And now when things have basically come to a standstill, what does that mean? I think swimming is still something that is that is sorely needed. But I think what, on a sort of larger sense outside of swimming, is like, what are the ways in which we find essential to recharge and be able to come back to ourselves and also do all the responsibilities that have been foisted upon us all at once. Now, you know, it's like our family responsibilities, domestic partnerships, and work all compressed into the space that is the footprint of your home.
Like, I do want to point out though that you're writing a book.
you're not
idling necessarily.
I've sort of not really been writing a book. I've been, you know, I have definitely been idling in a way because my brain is broken. And so I recognize that I need the time to repair myself. And so how am I doing that? It's dunking my head in the ocean any chance I get, and then just kind of listening, you know, talking to people. It's strange times indeed.
it's an interesting concept, because as much as people are doing that, there's also lots of pressure to be productive, to learn new languages or pick up a new hobby or bake the newest, mm-hmm. best sourdough.
Right. Yeah.
So what's it like to have published a book in April 2020 and not be able to go on tour?
Oh, you know, at first I really mourned the death of my book tour. I really did. It was sad. And then because my nature is to be buoyant, I thought about what are the different ways that I can connect with people, you know, like we still need it. And so I reached out on Twitter. I started to do these virtual swims with writers and water people I admire, and kind of have conversations about what, you know, it evolved, right? So it was right when we were not quite cut off from the water, and then more and more people were. And so those conversations really, the tenor of them really changed and have become more poignant and more about missing a lot of things and yearning. And in the beginning, it was like more of an appreciation and like more about what is it that is the water does for us. And I think just we're moving in a direction of like, we're still not sure where we're going. I think just to have connection, however we can get it, is something that I've learned through this whole process of not being on a physical book tour, but being on a virtual one. And I almost mm-hmm. feel like because I have learned to conduct myself on these different channels now more fluidly, that maybe the world is more open to me. I don't know. It's kind mm-hmm. of...
Well, hopefully this time and your time swimming will bring you patience, and patience that you can carry forward for as long as you and the rest of us will need it. So I want to thank you so much for joining me, Bonnie Soy. Check out her new book, Why We Swim, which you can buy from a local bookstore or as an ebook. And where else can people connect with you?
On Twitter, on Bonnie Soy, BonnieSoy.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And as we've been doing the last few weeks, we'd like to always end with a performance piece, just to get our heads out of our heads for a moment. So we're going to close out our show tonight with a clip of Kim Nally, Bay Area singer and performer. She's going to be singing here the song, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, that she performed at a tribute to Nina Simone at Lincoln Center. We hope you enjoy it.
Maybe I could fix things up and then it'll go. What's the matter, Danny? Come on, soothe my soul. Oh, I need some sugar in my bowl. Some sugar in my bowl.
It's
So that's City Visions for this Wednesday. I want to thank our guests, Aaron Alday of the San Francisco Chronicle, Dr. Peter Chin Hong of UCSF, and Bonnie Tsui, author of Why We Swim. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to tell us what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org.